This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Money Manager Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday edition of Invest Talk, September 8th, 2014 edition of Invest Talk. And we are here for you 5 days a week, helping in any way we can. And that 5 day a week thing is a little more pertinent today because of one of my talking points than it is other days. But we'll get to that coming up. Now, you can reach us in California, Northern and Southern California, on terrestrial stations. You can also listen to us live on investtalk.com or archive shows. You can listen on investtalk.com as well. And you can subscribe to our podcast if you are so inclined. And you can listen when it suits your schedule. So we have listeners from all facets of the ways to get connected with us. And we welcome all of you. And not only do we welcome you, but we also welcome your questions and your comments as well at 888-99-CHART. That's how to reach us right now on Invest Talk. And I know you have questions on your mind, so please jump in right now. We'll get to the phones in just a moment. Now, one major financial story that's worth a few moments of our time today is the next month China is going to open its stock market to the whole world. Steve writes about this in his market commentary today. And what will that mean for investors? Now, Steve explains overseas money managers will be able to buy listed Shanghai companies through Hong Kong. And China will be keeping a tight lid on how and who buys what. But in essence, they are allowing foreign ownership, which in the past has been extremely difficult. Still not the easiest way to invest, but it's they're starting to open up their markets a little bit. So why is China doing this? Well, this is an obvious move by China to become more influential in the world as they open up not only their stock market a bit, but they have been doing the same thing with their currency. And as Steve points out, this is not exactly a free market, but freer than they once were. So it's an expansion of their financial system, an opening of their financial system, but it's not quite the level that we're at or a lot of developed economies are at. Now, there's big differences. These are big differences from our market. For one thing, Chinese listed companies do not have the same disclosure rules or corporate governance standards as we have in the West. Certain accounting and auditing frameworks that we have set up here in America and in European markets that make investing in our companies a lot safer because there's checks and balances. Not that there aren't frauds. There's always frauds. There's always ways around frauds. It just makes it a lot harder to hide it. But in China, there's less corporate governance standards, so it's easier to pull off frauds. Not to say that every company over there is a fraud, but it happens. And you've seen recent history with some ADRs of Chinese stocks listed on U.S. exchanges. There's been a lot of research and on some of them, and big reports from the likes of Muddy Waters and a lot of these other research firms that have shed the light on some of the risky names over there, the risky companies, the fraudulent companies that are being exposed there on a regular basis. This hasn't been so much lately because I think most of them were exposed in the past, but I'm sure there are more out there. So I encourage you to read Steve's complete commentary on this topic. It's there for you on investtalk.com. Now, do you have an opinion about this new market for world investors? We can talk more about that today. You pick the topic. I am ready to answer your questions and talk about whatever is on your mind on this Monday edition of Invest Talk. And you can talk to us live, 4 to 5 Pacific time, or in between times. Just leave your question. And here's our first question of the day from our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.
Hi. I have a question on leveraged ETFs. I've been trading these back and forth in these crazy markets and was wondering if I have any risk of these guys going out. I mean, you're talking about derivatives and stuff. Do I have any concern there? Thank you.
Well, you have concern over time because there are there's what's called tracking error with a lot of these ETFs, leverage ETFs. So, you know, you hold these for, I mean, I don't want to say any, but most extended period of times, you're not going to do very well. So don't think that they're the holy grail or anything like that. And you don't have a lot of risk on a short-term basis, I don't think, you know, unless that asset class goes against you. Obviously, you're leveraged, so you know what type of risk you have there. But, you know, with derivatives, that's how they create this leverage, is they use derivatives. And so that's why there's tracking, there's costs. You know, it just makes those type of instruments more expensive and inherently more volatile because they have that that leverage. So you do have increasing amount of risk, but not a whole lot more than you would expect from, you know, from a leveraged vehicle. Right? So if it's two times leverage, do you have twice as much risk as that particular asset class? It's three times leverage, you have that particular risk from that asset class. But to say that they're going to blow up or go to zero because of some short-term derivatives blow up or something, I don't see that happening. But they're definitely trading vehicles. You don't want to hold them for a long period of time. You want to keep them relatively short-term, all right? So he's asking about leveraged ETFs and whether they can blow up. And I'd say they can only blow up as much as that asset class can blow up. Now, gaining popularity among do-it-yourself investors, they're active to those looking to expand beyond stocks, bonds, and treasuries. They're called self-directed IRAs. But you better know your stuff. What does this mean? What is a self-directed IRA, and what do you need to know about it? That's our main talking point today. But I have a few others as well. I want to talk about the five-day work week. Five-day work week. Where did it come from? How was it created? And is it obsolete? Larry Page, the founder and CEO of Google, kind of thinks so. And there's a lot of evidence, a lot of studies that really a five-day work week is not the greatest way to work. It's not the greatest way to run a company. There's a lot of benefits to maybe shortening the work week. I'll give you some examples of what some companies have done to change it up. And I think it's very interesting. I think we need to start having an open dialogue about the five-day work week. Not to say it should definitely go away, but there's certainly evidence that it should be discussed on how and what type of companies maybe can shorten their work week. So I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about infrastructure. Rebuilding America. Ooh, there's an article from, where was this written? I think it was the Washington Post. I believe it was the Washington Post. And there's two authors. One was the chairman of the Municipal Assistance Corporation during the 70s New York fiscal crisis. He's also an investment banker. And another is executive director of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. And they talk about what needs to be done to improve our economy, improve our situation economically long-term, competitively. And I think it's very, very important. We've talked about it in the past. I know Steve has talked about it in the past. And I think it's worth revisiting. And then the Federal Reserve's policy dilemma. Policy dilemma. What does it mean? What are they thinking? What is the economic reality right now? And what are the risks going forward of their exit from the taper tantrum? What else? I think that's it. That's all that I want to talk about. But I want to hear from you. 888-99 chart is our number, 888-992-4278. Now there's a new way to participate on InvestTalk, and it's our InvestTalk Twitter opinion poll. Here's this week's question. Do you believe you're taking too much risk with your retirement portfolio? Or maybe not enough? We'd love to read your answer on the program. Send it via Twitter now to @InvestTalk, and we will read your answers and possibly your questions as well. That's InvestTalk with two T's. That's the Twitter handle, @InvestTalk. And you can get your question to us the same way. Just ask your question, make a statement, whatever you want to talk to us about, whatever message you want to send, you can send it via Twitter, @InvestTalk, or the old-fashioned telephone works as well. Call 888-99-CHART.
Let's get back to you and your questions on InvestTalk. Are you an InvestTalk insider? There's a library of webinars that you can access, Profiting in a Rising Interest Rate Environment. The information in this webinar could have an impact on your retirement portfolio for years to come. Sign up for free right there on InvestTalk.com.
Let's go to Steve in Portland. How are you doing, Steve?
Hi, thank you. I have a question about bond mutual funds. And, you know, there's a lot of talk now about interest rates going up and that sort of thing. I own several individual bonds, and I hold them to maturity. So I never pay attention to the value of the bonds at the current time, because I know that when they mature, I'll get my money back and I receive the coupon in the meantime.
As long as you don't get a default, right?
As long as they don't default, that's correct. So as long as you choose properly. So with bond mutual funds, you know, sure, if interest rates go up, the value of the mutual fund goes down. But eventually, those bonds will turn over, and if you keep the duration short, eventually, it'll go back up again. So if you're a long-term investor, and don't just invest for next year, you know, you invest forever, decades, what difference does it make? Am I thinking wrong here? Am I just thinking, well, eventually it'll go back up, so what's the big deal if it goes down, because I'm not selling?
Well, it won't go back. It won't go back to that par if interest rates stay higher than where they were when you bought it, because that's always going to it's always going to continue to depreciate as long as interest rates go up. Now, it might not depreciate, you know, dramatically, depending on what type of outlook you have. Now, and over a long period of time, a long term, and that's kind of what you're talking about. What is the return that you're going to get over an extended period of time with a bond fund, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Whatever the yield is on that particular bond fund, that should be your expected return over the long term.
Right.
So if it's yielding 3.5%. Expect 3.5% over the long term for that particular bond fund. Now, if we have 30 years of interest rates rising, which that's a typical cycle that we've been having over the past 150, 200 years, is 30 years up, 30 years down. And so odds are good that we're going to have 30 years of interest rates rising. Now, how much are they going to rise? Maybe they go from, you know, what did the 10-year drop down to? About 1.4%, 1.5% a couple of years ago. And now, you know, we're at 2.5%. Could go higher than that, but is it going to go to, you know, 18% like it was in the late 70s? Or is it going to go to, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9% in 30 years? It's hard to know the magnitude. But over time, yes, your yield will be your return on that particular bond fund will probably be whatever the interest rate is at the time that you purchase it.
Okay, that's terrific. And what do you consider kind of a good duration to be in right now?
I like the 3 to 5 year duration. Yeah, I think you get enough yield, but it's also not too long to where if interest rates rise, you're getting smacked.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for calling. Now, do you want to talk about researching companies? Give me a call at 888-99-CHART. We'll be right back after this break.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. Coming up on the next Invest Talk, how investors beat themselves, counterproductive market timing and fund selection, investors chasing performance. That's our talking point for Tuesday, September 9th. We hope you'll listen to that podcast. You can sign up for our weekly premium newsletter on investtalk.com. It comes out every Friday. You can try it for a month risk-free. It's just $9.95 a month. Just scroll down to the bottom of the homepage on investtalk.com. InvestTalk continues on this Monday, how investors beat themselves. That's our talking point on the next InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART is how to get through right now to Justin. You name the topic.
Let's go to Mike in San Jose. How you doing, Mike?
Good, thank you, Justin. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I had a quick question on GDX, the gold miners. What are your thoughts might be on that? Is it a buy or...
Well, it's definitely right at support right here, right near the 200 moving average, 618 retrace, previous breakout area. So there's a lot of support in this area. It's definitely got a hold. Gold's been weak recently because the dollar has been really surging, but in relation to how strong the dollar's been, relatively gold's been holding up pretty decently. So I'm still a fan of gold. It's chart is choppy and but positive overall.
Positive overall, but do you feel in the coming months or so it'd be a good bet to just kind of buy and hold?
Yeah, I mean you obviously have to have some tolerance for volatility because gold and gold miners are notoriously volatile. You'll have just look at GDX. It went from $22 to almost $28 a share in the span of a month. That's a pretty big move, and now it's given to about two-thirds of that back, now down to about $24 and change. So you have to be willing to accept that type of volatility. But overall, the chart still looks constructive. But it's it needs to find some support here, and it should. But if it doesn't, then you start to get worried.
But you yourself are comfortable because I know you guys have gold position.
I'm comfortable. Steve's probably a little less comfortable than I am, but I'm still fairly comfortable.
Wonderful. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Mike. Let's go to Don in Pleasant Hill. How you doing, Don?
Really well. Yourself?
Doing well. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm looking to retire somewhere between 4 and 9 years. I have your typical IRA, 403B, wife has the IRA. Also have a nice amount of money and just your basic stock market stuff.
Okay.
I'm ultimately looking to move it over to a dividend or income producing stream. When's a good time to do that, considering I'm, 4 to 9 years out?
You said you're 4 to 9 years out?
Yeah, before I want to retire.
Well, I think a lot of it depends on, what type of dividend stream are you talking about? Are you talking about something in the stock market? Are you talking about rental income?
I'm looking at stock market. I'm looking at stock market, the various companies with the dividends.
Mm-hmm. Are you
moving? Yes, sir.
Are you? How are you invested currently? Are you aggressive, conservative?
I am more on the aggressive side.
Okay.
Let me see. Right now, I've been playing with the dividends. I have HCP. And I have Altera.
Okay.
I have a few of them that I'm sort of playing with, but I'm looking at the bulk where I'll want to move it from Apple over to something that really does give me a stream of income I could live off of. And so when do I start decreasing a position in the market and move it over to an income stream?
Yeah. I think you're definitely in that zone. You're starting to get there. 5 to 9 years. That's definitely in that in that range. So I would start doing that now. You know, just at least a little bit, not aggressively, but a little bit. You know, it's hard right now because everyone's chasing yield. You know, it's just not a great time to be searching out yielding, you know, income or investments that produce good income, because you tend to push yourself out into areas of the marketplace that are risky, and especially risky for somebody who is, you know, is a retiree or a potential retiree coming up. So, you know, anything with a good dividend right now, you know, you're talking junk bonds, and that's just not a good place to be by any stretch of the imagination at the current time. So, you know, what level of income are you looking for? You know, 4%, 2.5%? I mean, what are you thinking?
No, I would prefer the 4 or higher, but I don't really want to go too dangerous. So I figure 4, I could probably find something relatively safe. I have AT&T. It's at 5. I have a number already that I'm sort of playing with, but I haven't really moved my money.
Yeah. Well, I think now is the time to do that, and I would definitely try to stick with very large cap companies, ones that are less cyclical. I like, you know, AT&T. You know, we own that in our balanced income program. So that's a type of name that we like for our clients. And so if you're going to move money there, I would definitely do it in very large, stable, anti-cyclical. And that's very important. Anti-cyclical names that are, you know, they might still go down, but they're still going to maintain their dividend, and their earnings volatility won't be, you know, dramatic in a recession. So I would start to do it now, but not aggressively.
Does it matter if I should move the qualified compared to the non-qualified funds? Once I start to sell them, the ones in the qualified account, I won't be paying the capital gains on, compared to the ones that are non-qualified in the stock market. Once I start to sell, it's going to be 20%.
Yeah. So, Don, hold on 1 second. We're going to go to break, and I'll get right back to your call. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
You're listening to Invest Talk with portfolio manager Justin Klein. Here's today's dose of wisdom, a quote from Stephen Covey. I'm not a product of my circumstance. I am a product of my decisions. Can we help you make better choices today? Call and talk to Justin about it. 888-99-CHART.
Now, for the break, we're talking to Don about retirement. And you said you're about 4 to 9 years away from retirement.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you want to, if you're thinking about moving, you know, into more income-producing investments in retirement, which makes a lot of sense. Now, how confident are you that you have enough money to retire, or you're going to have enough money to retire in, you know, 5 years or so?
Well, right now I have about 1.5 in the non-qualified, you know, the stock market and such, and savings and such, and about 600 in the qualified. So, and plus I have kids, and so I'm relatively, and I have no debt.
Yeah.
The house will be paid off in a few years. So I'm relatively confident.
Okay.
So the 4 years should be fine. 9 I could still see doing. And so it's just a matter of saying, great, I have these two buckets of money. It's my understanding I can play with my 401s or my IRAs or my whatever, I can play with that as long as they don't touch it.
Yeah.
I can maneuver that. So it doesn't matter what I do right now there. As far as the what I have in the stock market, to sell it and convert it over, it would probably make more sense to wait until I retire to start playing with that bucket of money, right?
Now you said you had 1.5 million qualified, and then what was the other one?
The 1.5 is a non-qualified, and about 600 in the qualified.
Okay, so you have about $2.1 million. And how much are you still saving any more money, or are you just kind of, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, still saving.
What do you save in a month?
To be honest with you, that I don't have.
Okay.
I, I should. I know everything else.
But, yeah. Do you know how much you're going to spend in retirement, like per month?
Or at least would have to
withdraw from this, you know, minus Social Security and all that.
Yeah, the house will be paid for. Wife and I don't have this flamboyant lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying 50, I'll say 70 just to be on the safe side. I really can't imagine spending over 70,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I don't know how we can even do that, really.
And what year were you born?
56.
Okay. Well, see, this is a great. I'm not trying to get too personal with you, but we have our own internal system. I'm just kind of giving you an idea of where you're at, and I think it's important because, you know, you're talking about getting an income stream,
Right.
What I think is important for everybody to understand is. You know, you need to know how much money you have and how much money you're going to need in retirement, and then you can kind of pinpoint what type of risks you can take. You know, and I'm just using an example here of $5,000 a month withdrawing. Is that, do you think that's conservative,
sure.
Or would you do more?
Sure, that sounds perfectly fine. Like I said, the house, the big one's going to be paid off. So how much traveling are we going to do? Other than that, we really don't have a huge amount of expenses.
Yeah. See, I think, and I'm putting you're going to retire in 2020. You know, I really think you're in a great position, and you really don't need to, you know, invest that that aggressively. If you're only going to take $5,000, dollars out a month, you know, even $6,000 is a pretty good number. So, you know,
right.
I wouldn't, don't try to reach for yield, especially this environment, because, you know, you don't really need to take a lot of risk. You don't really need high returns to really maintain yourself in your retirement years. You know, you don't want to take too much risk searching for that yield and then suffer, you know, big losses, you know, if there's a recession or a bear market, and then, that puts your retirement nest egg in a precarious situation where it really doesn't need to be. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So go for it.
So perhaps it would even be better to hold off on repositioning myself, because I could actually sell some shares in order to get the income I need.
Exactly.
When the time comes.
You know, a lot of people focus on income in retirement, and income is definitely good, but there are many studies that show that it's not necessarily the best road to take in everybody's case. Like I said, it's really all about what type of risk level that you're able and willing to take, and what type of risk you should take based on how much money you have and how much money you're going to spend in retirement. And these are the type of conversations, you know, we have with clients all the time. And so, you know, a lot of people rest on conventional wisdom, when in reality, everyone's situation is a little bit different. And you have a very, very large nest egg, especially compared to the average person. And it doesn't sound like you're going to be an aggressive spender in retirement. And so I think you should really kind of try to assess where you're at when it comes to what type of risk you should be taking. And it's, going to income, yes, that usually reduces your risk, but not always. It depends on where you're going for that. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. So I would encourage you. We have a risk calculator on our website. If you want to go there, you can you can take the quick quiz. It's 5 minutes. It's very simple. It takes less than 5 minutes, and then I can run this retirement map for you in maybe even more details. If we send a few emails back and forth.
Okay. Sounds great. All right. Thank you much.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jack in Oceanside. Oh, Jack's gone. Jack, I was sorry, Jack. I was trying to help Don and trying to give everyone kind of a little bit insight on how you should think about retirement. And don't think, everyone's situation is different. So not all conventional wisdom applies perfectly to everybody. And that's why, you know, we use tools to figure out where everybody is. You know, Don had over $2 million. The odds are most people aren't going to have $2 million saved away 5 years before retirement. Should they? Probably. You know, Don's in a great situation. He doesn't need to save a lot more money. He just needs to manage that money properly and manage his risk properly so that he has enough money, and you know, for the rest of his life, him, you know, him and his family. So, you know, but other people, you might be, you might only have, you know, $500,000 or $600,000 a few years away from retirement. Some people even less. So you might have to work a few more years. Maybe you have to withdraw a little bit less. Maybe you need to take a little bit more investment risk. Everyone's situation is a little bit different, and that's, you know, why professionals have tools to figure that out. And that's what I was trying to do with Don right there. It was kind of rough and crude, but it was hopefully helpful for Don and everyone else out there. Now, our talking point today is relates a little bit to what Don was talking about. I'm talking about self-directed IRAs, and you know, there's a lot of pitfalls associated with self-directed IRAs that could end up costing you money if you aren't careful. Now, there's different types of the IRA is just a type of account, and there are self-managed IRAs, meaning you know, you set up that IRA at E-Trade or Schwab or Prudent, where you know, a brokerage firm, and you go online, you make the trades. You do that yourself. You choose the stocks, bonds, mutual funds that you think fit your portfolio the best, your needs the best. Now, the biggest pitfall there is not understanding your risk profile and not understanding how to match that up with the assets that are in your IRA. Especially for the average person. They don't, a lot of people don't have the tools. Usually 99.9% of people don't have the right tools for that. So it's really about understanding what you're investing in a self-managed IRA. Then there's a self-directed IRA, and that involves setting up your account as some sort of custodian and making investments in things like real estate, private placements, metals, based on your directive. So you have a broker, and they come to you with ideas, or say you want to invest in some type of asset class, and they bring these investments to you. Now, this money grows tax-free over time, but there are a lot of pitfalls. You know, you can take some of that money and invest it in real estate, but there are tax implications that make a lot of this complex, especially if you're getting a stream of cash flow from whatever you're putting that money into. And you need to be aware of that. And a lot of times, you know, a broker may not tell you or might not disclose everything about the investments that they're selling you and the tax implications. And it's very common for real estate investors to put down a percentage of the home from their IRA to buy as a rental property, and then they borrow the rest from the bank, right? And you know, these type of assets and other debt-financed assets involve investment or income that is taxable. It could be taxable at a different beyond, you know, that growth. Remember, the growth of an IRA is tax deferred. But if you borrow money, you leverage that money up, you borrow it, and you get money coming in from an investment property or something like that, that income, or the majority of that income, will be taxed. So understand that there are tax implications that really come to light when you start stepping outside of the traditional, you know, buying a stock or a bond or a mutual fund. It can get complicated. And it can even get complicated in there. If you buy master limited partnerships, you buy REITs, those things can all of a sudden complicate your tax situation. So you need to be aware of that and have a good accountant if you're going to start venturing out beyond, you know, the typical stock and mutual funds and bonds that you buy in an IRA. Now, when this new week ends, you can read a market recap in our premium newsletter. It comes out every single Friday. It's quick and easy to read. It's an easy to keep, and it keeps you informed and helps you gain some perspective on the market and investing in general. It's just $9.99 a month, and you can sign up for a year at a discount or take it 1 month at a time. To subscribe, just go to investtalk.com.
If you'd like to catch up on Steve's market commentaries, we've saved them for you. Click on Market Commentary Blog on investtalk.com and select them from a long list right there for you on investtalk.com.
Hi, Steve. Megan calling from Colorado. Quick question. I want to know about Western Gas. It's a Master Limited Partnership, WES. I'm thinking about putting this in my portfolio as a long-term holding. But it looks like the price to earnings are kind of high, and it has a K-1. So, but I don't know. It looks like it could do really well in light of where this country is going with oil and gas investing. Just give your opinion. Love the show. Listen to it in podcast. Thanks again.
Western Gas Partnerships. This is a master limited partnership. That's why it has a K-1. So understand that the dividend that you're getting is tax at your ordinary income tax rate. So it's not the 20% qualified dividend that you would get from, you know, a Procter & Gamble or a Johnson & Johnson or an AT&T. Okay? So it's a little bit different. So that yielding about 3.4%, I would look at that more like a 2.5% to 3% dividend yield, depending on your tax rate. Obviously, if you're in the highest tax bracket, well, it becomes a lot less attractive. If you're in the lower tax bracket, well, it becomes a little bit closer to that 20% rate, right? So that's Western Gas Partnerships. Now, it is growing. They're a mass limited partnership engaged in natural gas gathering, compressing, treating, and transporting in Texas, Rocky Mountains, and the mid-continent United States. Now, revenue is accelerating, growing 25-30% quarter over quarter. Nice, solid growth. Earnings supposed to grow 25% this year, 11% next year. PE's 35, a little steep for my liking. Low debt level. I like that, especially for a company that is in an industry that tends to have pretty low debt ratings. So I'm sure their debt rating isn't very great, but the fact that they don't have a ton of debt is definitely encouraging. Now, they have negative cash flow, which, you know, is pretty typical for a mass limited partnership because they're paying out so much in dividends. But their payout ratio is 107%. It was over 200%. So it's come down, so that makes it a little more attractive. Return on equity is growing. It was at 4.5% in 2012. Now it's at 10.5%. So I like the growth in profitability, the growth in overall sales, the growth in overall profitability. That is attractive. So I like what she's looking at, but you know that yield is not getting me very, very excited. I would say I kind of like it. I'm not head over heels because natural gas prices are coming down. Energy prices are coming down, and if oil and natural gas prices come low enough, it suddenly becomes uneconomical for shale drilling, and that could hurt a company like this and the whole sector as a whole. And a lot of the companies in this sector have been taking it on the chin recently. So I worry that could eventually spread to something like Western Gas. So I think I kind of like it. But there is a lot of worries, and it is high risk. I would probably wait until you see a substantial sell-off and keep it on your radar, and then pick it up when you see a substantial drop, because there likely will be one. Now, if you live in Northern California and been thinking about a portfolio checkup, Steve will be in San Jose September 17th. He'll be in San Diego County on the 24th. And if you'd like to schedule an hour with Steve, just go to investtalk.com, click on a make an appointment, and we'll work out the details.
Thanks for being a podcast subscriber. And even though you listen after our daily production time, you can still be part of the discussion. Your questions and comments set the tone and the topics, so please participate. Just call 888-99-CHART anytime. And if you'd like to talk live to Steve and Justin,
Just make that call between 4 and 5 p.m. Pacific time. This is Invest Talk. Justin's open to any money matter on your mind, from return on equity to investing in real estate. 888-99-CHART is how to get through to Invest Talk right now.
Let's go to Vic in San Jose. How are you doing, Vic?
Hi, Justin. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
This one I want to talk about is UAN, mm-hmm. which is a fertilizer MLP.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got over 9% yield, and I'm kind of wondering, is it safe?
Is it safe? Well, first, just like the last caller was asking about Western Gas, remember, this is a master limited partnership. Actually, no, it's not a master limited partnership. They just manufacture nitrogen fertilizer utilizing a petroleum coke gasification process, primarily for the agricultural market. So It is a fertilizer company, but their earnings have been falling. 34% this year, only supposed to fall 1% next year. But you know, who knows? That might be even better, or might be even worse. You know, so let's see. Is there dividend safe? No, definitely not. Its payout ratio is 118%. So meaning they're paying out 18% more in the dividend than they're earning in profits. Now, how do they do that? Well, they can issue more debt, which, let's see, it doesn't look like they're doing that. Yeah, a little bit, but nothing dramatic. They're issuing more shares? No, they're issuing more shares. So, it looks like they just recently cut their dividend. Yeah, they just cut their dividend. So, that previous dividend going backwards is not going to be what you see going forward. So don't think you're getting that 9% yield.
Hmm. Would you buy this at this price?
Or? No. This isn't a huge downturn. I mean, it is near support here. It's fallen from almost $22 a share down to $15 a share to the lows of last year. But there's nothing on the chart that's telling me this should be turning around, and nothing fundamentally that says it's going to turn around. You know, earnings are still supposed to fall next year, although, you know, much less than it is this year. Revenue fell 13% year over year last quarter. Earnings fell 52%. I'm just not seeing anything exciting about this company at all.
Yeah, I thought this, since this is a fertilizer, maybe it's a little different than oil and gas and all that, you know.
It definitely is, but, you know, corn price, agricultural prices are falling pretty dramatically recently, especially corn. You know, some are going up, but, you know, corn is pretty much the number one agricultural good out there, and it's been taken on the chin. So, and overall, you know, just look at Mosaic and Potash, those have been not doing very well either. They've been struggling. So, and this is not a leader in the industry or anything like that. Profitability's falling, and so I would stay away from it.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling, Vic. Now, before we wrap up for the day, let's talk about the 5-day work week. I think this is extremely interesting. Now, so think about the 5-day work week. Everyone just takes the 5-day work week for granted. Like, oh, we're supposed to have a 5-day work week, the weekends. But where did it come from? You know, the year marks one revolution around the sun. A month supposedly marks a time between full moons. But, you know, the 7-day work week goes back to Babylon 4,000 years ago. They believed there were 7 planets in the solar system, and the number 7 held such power to them that they planned their days around it. Their 7-day planetary week spread to Egypt, Greece, eventually to Rome, and where it turns out the Jewish people had their own version of the 7-day work week. So the 7-day work week was firmly entrenched in the Western calendar about 250 years before Christ was born. Now, in the 19th century, Britons would drink, gamble, and enjoy themselves so much that the phenomenon of Saint Monday occurred. So they would party on Sundays, right? The scripture said you rest on Sundays. Well, they would drink and gamble so much that they didn't show up to work on Mondays. And the English factory owners later compromised workers, giving them half day on Saturday in exchange for guarantees that they would attend on Monday. Now, it took decades for Saturdays to change from half day to a full rest day, and in 1908, a New England mill became the first American factory to institute the five-day week. Officially. So that's a little bit of some history of the five-day work week. I'm going to hold on to this. I'm going to be doing the show later in the week, and I want to talk a little bit more about this, because to me this is fascinating, I think it's interesting, and I think it should be an open discussion, because there's a lot of evidence that a five-day work week is really no longer makes a lot of sense. Now, before we close the hour, I invite you to try our new investment risk analyzer. Lots of our listeners are doing it. It only takes about 3 to 5 minutes on our website, investtalk.com, and you can use it for free. It will help you learn your true tolerance for investment risk. I'm portfolio manager Justin Klein, and on behalf of Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, we hope you'll join us again on the next Invest Talk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.